Hello, today I'm talking with Bill of the Surveillance Camera Players. Bill, why is it important to know about the location of surveillance cameras?
The most important reason about knowing not only the locations of the surveillance cameras, but how many there are, is that many people, even activists, have no idea of how many cameras there really are that are watching us, and that they're positioned pretty much everywhere in public spaces, even where you wouldn't expect them. So that it's important to realize this because it's changing the entire quality or fabric of everyday life. Whether we realize it or not, the police are increasingly able to track our movements. And especially since September 11th, they're proposing to put up a lot more cameras with even greater technical abilities so that we will find ourselves here in New York and America subject to the same levels of surveillance that activists find themselves in Europe, where they cannot even cross international boundaries now to go to protests because there are photographs of them available at the borders when they cross. So that the reason that we want to pay attention to this now is what's on the horizon in the short term, what's going to be happening in the near future.
How do the police use those cameras now? And how could they use them in the future?
The way that the police use the cameras now is by putting them in locations where there are often protests, not labeling them and using them specifically to watch protesters. For example, there's such a protester camera right in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. There's no crime in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. However, there's lots of protests outside the building because of the policies of the Catholic Church. Right in front there, there's a digital camera that goes right to an ISDN line, which means that anybody who knows the phone number that you can dial into can watch what's going on there. So that this camera is not there for stopping homelessness, drug dealing, purse snatchings, any kind of crime in front of St. Patrick's, but it's so that the police can zero in and click very good digital pictures of protesters without even having to get out of their precinct office or even out of their cars. They can just sit there in the precinct office, zoom in on people's faces with this camera in front of St. Patrick's, and click away. And what they're doing, no doubt, is getting to know all of the protesters, getting a nice photograph of them, matching their name to such a photograph, and then developing dossiers so they can figure out who's at the protests, who's likely to travel to other places, and who's likely to do what at the next protest.
How has the function of the cameras changed since the 9/11 terrorist attacks?
Well, the function of the cameras has very literally changed in that since 9/11, especially in America, there's been an explosion in the use of face recognition software, which we talked about earlier and we can go into now as well. And that the function of a surveillance camera used to be kind of like a super lens for a police officer. Now there's no police officer behind the cameras watching. There's a computer program doing it. And that the reason why they want to do this is to supposedly to stop terrorism. But what it means is that surveillance cameras can now watch not just 10, 20, or 100 people, but could watch potentially millions of people because a computer can do things that a human being can't. So that now face recognition enhanced surveillance cameras are being installed in airports. And from what I've heard, Howard Safier, who now sits on George Pataki's Board of Homeland Security, also wants to put them into Times Square as well. So there are not only going to be more cameras since September 11th, they're going to be technologically the most sophisticated cameras we've ever seen.
Now, you're talking about New York City. Do you know if these are used in other cities in the States or in other countries?
Well, in America, surveillance cameras are becoming a wall-to-wall, coast-to-coast, border-to-border phenomenon. The most common of them now are the so-called red light surveillance cameras, which are surveillance cameras used to watch traffic patterns at intersections. And they supposedly stop people from running red lights. Really what it is a scam so that the city can then make huge amounts of money giving false tickets that are automatically given by the cameras. So yes, these sorts of cameras, whether they're traffic surveillance cameras or police cameras that are just watching public places, exist all over America, not just in New York, but in every major city. Now, mind you that America still is not super saturated with cameras in the way that England is. There must be a camera for every 50 people in England, and here in the United States it hasn't reached those kinds of alarming proportions. But I get email from people all over the world, from Tokyo, from Athens, from Lithuania, from Stockholm, saying that the police are now installing digital surveillance cameras in public. So it isn't just something limited to New York or America. This is becoming a phenomenon of global capitalism. Capital wants now to be able to watch all of its properties all over the world and is spending billions of dollars a year to ensure that they can do that.
So we've been talking mostly about public spaces. Could you go into private spaces and businesses and how the cameras are used there and who can set them up?
Well, there's a big difference between public and private spaces. In the private spaces, there the cameras are not so much there to supposedly to crack down on crime, but they're there to reduce insurance rates. They're there so the employers can watch the employees to make sure that they're not goofing off or stealing, so that when a member of the public walks into, say, Kinko's or Strawberry's or HMV Records, you will be watched very, very carefully. These private companies will be filled with surveillance cameras, and they're watching to see potential shoplifters, but they're also using it as a tool to keep their labor force in place, a way of disciplining them, a way of firing people that they don't like. And it's a very big issue in the workplace whether workers have the right to have their privacy on the job. And we're contacted very frequently by people, especially in the airlines industry, who are in the process of having a union grievance against the management because somebody has been unfairly dismissed because they were captured by a surveillance camera. When you deal with public spaces, however, it's something different. I think reasonable people can agree that when you're a member of the public and you walk inside of a private business, when you go through a door, you realize that you're no longer in public and you're in somebody's private premises, and therefore you have the suspicion that you might be watched. In public, however, it seems you have the unconditional expectation of privacy in public because you haven't selected yourself out of the crowd. You haven't walked through a door. And when you're inside of Kinko's, it seems you are being asked to give up some privacy in exchange for using their services, and that seems somewhat acceptable. When you're out in public, you haven't made any exchange whatsoever, and you should never, ever be watched by a surveillance camera when you're in public. The people who are watching in private spaces are always private security firms or the businesses themselves. When you deal in public spaces, it's a mixture. Not only do you have private security firms and private security guards, but you've also got the police. The police do not watch inside of private businesses, but they do watch out in public a great deal. I would say that the vast majority of cameras in public are owned by private companies, but the ones that really upset people are the ones that are operated by the police. The police must conduct surveillance in strict accordance with the laws of this country. The Fourth Amendment and all of the laws that derive from it apply to the police first and foremost, and only secondarily to the private sector. So it seems that if we have the most concern or opposition to surveillance, it should be to the police's use of surveillance cameras out in public, because that's the one that's the most serious violation of our constitutional rights.
Who can set up these cameras? Is it regulated or not?
In America, the use of surveillance cameras is totally unregulated. Anybody can put a camera anywhere they want, and indeed that's what's happening. The city doesn't keep track of who puts up a camera. The city doesn't have any kind of licensing or approval. The city doesn't make sure that the people who are watching the cameras are trained in how to use the cameras in a way that's sensitive to privacy rights and other things. So in America, it's a totally lawless condition. In the European countries, however, there the government keeps track of and has to actually approve of the installation of surveillance cameras. They don't actually do that. So in England, there's supposed to be a registry that if you put up a surveillance camera and you're a private business, you have to register that camera with the government by law. But as it turns out, people are not doing that. So even though there are laws in Europe that say you must apply to the government to put up a camera, the government is not enforcing these laws, so either side of the Atlantic, cameras are going up no matter without any regulation. And mind you, it's not just the government and the police. It's not just big companies that are putting up cameras. It's also neighborhood block associations. It's also landlords and tenants in buildings and private individuals as well. We're getting to a moment in society where people are so paranoid or so addicted to being spectators and voyeurs that everybody is beginning to watch everybody else. So our solution is not to shoot back, in other words, not to surveil the surveillers, but to advocate the banning of all surveillance devices in public.
Is this a loophole in the Constitution?
Yes, that's exactly what it is a loophole in both the language of the Fourth Amendment and also the language of the 1968 Crime Act and the 1986 update to the federal statutes. When it comes to audio surveillance, the government, at least prior to the John Ashcroft, George Bush era, prior to then, if the government or the police wanted to install an audio wiretap, surveillance or eavesdropping in public, they absolutely had to follow the law. They had to get a judge to swear out a warrant, and it had to be based on probable cause, and it had to be of limited duration. What we find is though, that when they updated the laws, they didn't add the word video. So that there's plenty of laws on the books concerning audio surveillance, and the loophole or hole in the law is the word video. So all we have to do, it sounds simple, it isn't, but all we have to do is update all of the laws that protect our privacy from audio surveillance to apply to video surveillance. But this is obviously going to be fought really viciously, especially now, because the Ashcroft, Bush, Mueller administration now has really destroyed the Fourth Amendment and most of the amendments in the Bill of Rights. And so now it's going to be, we're going to have to not only fight to hold on to what we used to have, but need to reclaim even more. So the battle now is that much more difficult. It's not only pointing out that there's a hole in the law, we have to seal it and make sure that our privacy is really protected.
Who can get access to these videotapes? Can they be used in a court of law? For example, could they be subpoenaed if they caught police smacking down protesters?
Yes, absolutely. That is, we're not talking now about private security cameras, but yes, the cameras that are operated by the police, since presumably they're a lawful authority, you could subpoena those tapes for either use against the police or for use in some sort of criminal trial. The problem would be that if you subpoena the tape from the police, either when you're fighting against the police or you want to have the police help you find a criminal, is that they have to admit that they're actually taping and keeping the videotapes, which is itself an admission that they don't want to make. Even if they are keeping the videotapes, that there's a problem with might be locating the footage that you want, and if it turns out that that footage does indeed show a Rodney King-style beating, they are probably going to lose that tape, blur it, erase it, find that they will erase all records of its being kept. so that even though you could presumably ask the police to see that videotape, you will obviously get a tremendous amount of resistance if you are asking for evidence of police misconduct. I've been contacted by email by people who will say, asking that exact same question, I'm an attorney representing somebody who is either the victim of police brutality or false arrest. Can the footage from surveillance cameras be used? And the answer is absolutely yes, if you're lucky enough to be able to get it from them.
Have there been cases where people have gotten the footage, and how do they get the footage?
I do not know of any cases in which people have gotten this footage. Mostly, the cases that I see are simply the police either giving the footage away or selling it illegally to tabloid news shows. There's a great many shows on television that uses surveillance footage, so obviously they're getting access to police footage, but they are not people who are trying to obey the law, enforce the law, have the law protect them. They're simply making a profit. So it seems that if video footage is released by the police, they only do it because of financial benefits that they can get from it. I do not know of any incidents in America where somebody has gotten video footage from the police for use in a criminal trial. In England, there's something called the Data Protection Act, and that means that for a fee of, say, £10 or so, you could actually write to the police department in London and say, I was in front of one of your surveillance cameras at exactly this time, this place, in this location. I would like to see the footage that you recorded of me. And you can supposedly get that from the British police. It takes about 6 months. And based on that idea, there's a comic named Mark Thomas, who's kind of the British Michael Moore, and he's sponsoring a competition of people to perform in front of surveillance cameras, ask the police to see the footage. Once you get the footage back, submit it in a competition. And from what I've heard is they're having a great deal of difficulty getting the footage from the police because, as I mentioned, they're very reluctant to admit that they're videotaping, and they're also very reluctant to say that how long they're storing these videotapes for. You would think that they would only store these videotapes for 24 hours, 48 hours, until it became clear that no crime was committed. Some European lawmakers in Europol or Interpol, people in the FBI, want tapes like this kept for years and years to make sure that no criminal activity was taking place at all, which means that there's now going to have to be rooms absolutely full of videotapes kept of the footage from surveillance cameras so they can search through it and find it, even if something took place years ago.
And whose interest is it to install and maintain and use this technology?
I would say the insurance companies, for one. That one of the reasons that the private sector installs so many surveillance cameras is that they can get a reduction on their insurance rates, because they can then say, well, we've installed the stuff to protect against fire, against crimes, against various losses. So you put a surveillance camera, not because you're afraid of crime, but you want a lowered insurance rate. And then if there is a crime, a property crime, you can use the footage from your surveillance camera to get money from the insurance company. So in other words, that really what a surveillance camera is just a capitalist scam. The people who are using it are only interested in financial motives. They're not really interested in stopping crime. They just want to get money from it. Now, that's the private sector. They want money, as always, having to do with insurance. The police supposedly put up cameras because they want to stop crime and terrorism now. But what I think it's quite clear that they're doing is they want to be able to get the feeling that they know everything that's going on in the city, that they can watch through their cameras, collate reports, and pass these reports back to themselves, and give themselves the feeling that they're actually in control, which is very important for the police. These cameras, mind you, are not labeled. And that If they really were there, that is the cameras, if they really were there to stop crime, you would think that a label would actually be more effective than the camera itself, because a criminal would look up, and instead of seeing sort of a bulb-like device and having to guess that it's a surveillance camera, the criminal, potential criminal, would simply look at the sign, see that they're being watched, and decide that the opportunity isn't good enough. The police are not labeling their cameras because this has nothing to do with crime. The police's motive has to do with social control. It's a big outdoor experiment. In scientific experiments, you don't let the subjects of the experiments know they're part of an experiment. That compromises the results. And that's what's happening on the streets of New York right now. The police are engaging in a social experiment. Let's see what it's like to watch people without their noticing it, and that's why there's no signs. So in other words, the police have a very different motive than the private sector for putting up cameras. The private sector is interested, as always, in money. The police are interested in something much more hard to understand, which is simply control and power. The sense that they can They actually are in control, when of course their control is completely imaginary and only flows out of the barrel of the gun. That we are the ones that have control over ourselves, but the cameras give the cops the illusion that they have the control.
How do surveillance cameras fit into the larger context of surveillance? For example, wiretapping and electronic surveillance and...
Well, there are many other forms of surveillance, and the point is very well taken. As we've mentioned, this audio surveillance. There's something called data valence or data surveillance, so that all you can be tracked by such non-visual phenomenon as your credit card records, your financial statements, your education history. And that what's happening now, it seems, is that we're making vast profiles that are made up of all the different forms of surveillance. And that because this is a visually obsessed culture, a picture taken from a surveillance camera is pretty much the top part of the pyramid. A picture, because as I said, this is a visually dominated culture, a picture gives your full data profile a face. So that now when there will be computers, you probably enter into an individual's file by their face. But once you're inside of that profile, there'll be visual surveillance, non-visual surveillance, audio surveillance, data surveillance. So what we're looking at is total profiles of the citizens. Not just what they look like, not just what they sound like, but all their behaviors and all the information about them. And it's a total package. So surveillance cameras are linked together in putting a face, as it were, on a profile that will supposedly reflect everything there is to know about you.
At this time, face recognition technology is somewhat crude. The camera will look and can easily make a mistake. How far away is technology which could identify a person, a unique person, and not anyone else?
Well, I think that surveillance cameras and face recognition technology will always fail when it comes to recognizing people, because people's faces change, and people are able to either change their faces intentionally, turn their faces away, but there will be technologies in which it's impossible to make these mistakes, or it's impossible to disguise yourself. And that will be when you're being surveilled by your DNA, or there's some sort of device planted underneath your skin that produces a totally distinctive signal. And those things will be less victim to the mistakes that you can make with visual images. After all, a visual image has to be translated into data for the computer to recognize you. But if you're beginning simply with data, a little beam that's sent out by some sort of transponder underneath your skin, it's going to be increasingly difficult to make mistakes about people's identities. So in that way, the emerging technologies of really keeping track of people is not going to be face recognition or software retinal recognition or any of these biometric things where you recognize a body. The body is itself going to be its own barcode. There'll be things implanted in the body that can't be removed or disguised. You can always put sunglasses on your face and disguise your face, but you can't put sunglasses over an implant underneath your skin. There's no way to disguise the beams that are being sent out. So in that way, what the future indicates is that there'll be forms of monitoring people and surveilling their movements that are almost errorless, or certainly less full of errors than face recognition software, which means that this battle that we're fighting for against surveillance technology and for privacy is really just beginning, especially here in New York, especially here in America. Other parts of the world, unfortunately, have gotten a very big jump on us, or rather surveillance technology is really very advanced in other countries. That's why our efforts are so important right now. We do have the opportunity to head something off because the iron, as it were, is hot today because of how much interest there is in surveilling public space after September 11.
Bill, can you explain unique identifier technology, that is technology which could recognize one human being apart from the other 5 billion people on the planet?
Well, yes, these are very familiar. For example, fingerprinting is a recognizer of a unique identity. Fingerprints are supposedly something that is unique to all of us. Now, that's a 19th century phenomenon. Now, the problem is you can't track somebody unless every step of the way they're leaving fingerprints. So that in between times you get a fingerprint, somebody could elude you. So that what modern technologies of identifying and tracking are going to do is put things in your body that send out a signal on a regular basis so that they don't have to wait for you to leave a fingerprint. They don't have to wait for you to pass by a surveillance camera that has face recognition software so it can recognize you. Those things are too passive. What they will do is actively allow you to be watched by putting something under your skin called a transponder, a digital angel. And what these things do is, instead of leaving traces that are then picked up later, they send out a steady signal that's picked up by the Global Positioning Satellite Network, which is a military technology, so that anywhere you go on the planet, the satellites can recognize the transponder under your skin. The satellites then create an image and download that image to the internet, where that picture of where you are on the planet can be watched. So that means that anything that's either chattel or human chattel can have a transponder stuck under its skin, can be watched by the GPS and the internet. And by human chattel or chattel, what I mean is by human pets that you want to track so that they don't get lost. Herds of sheep that you want to, or other forms of livestock. But you'd also want to track children, prisoners, prisoners of war, people that have been released from prison and are deemed to be dangerous, such as convicted sex offenders. So that now what you've done is created a whole category of people who are under permanent surveillance. And they will never have a private moment. Their location will always be visible on a blip on a screen. And in this way, this is a perfection of surveillance, in that it'll be impossible for you to have a moment where you're not being seen on these screens. There won't be a moment where in between surveillance cameras or in between fingerprintings, for a moment there, they've lost track of you. They will be able to know where you are continuously through these subcutaneous implants. And they turn basically human beings into those who are owners and those who are owned. It's as if we're now domesticating ourselves so that children, prisoners, are turned into totally, not even second-class humans, but almost subhumans, because they're watched almost always like they were objects and not people.
Have there been times in history when people have revolted against these technologies, and under what context were those revolts, and how did they happen?
Well, I'm aware of contemporary battles and revolts against surveillance. Those things, however, since this technology is so recent, I can't think of any event in battling against surveillance or surveillance technology that exists before maybe 1980 or so. The very first and most famous incidences of people battling against surveillance come out of East Germany, where people are fighting against the Stasi, or in Russia, people fighting against the KGB, that you'd hear these horrific stories of husbands spying on wives, wives spying on husbands, children spying on parents, and that whole subterranean forms of life where people would create super private lives would take place. And there was apparently a whole form of humor, forms of communication that would take place in the Eastern Bloc countries where people were not revolting openly in the streets, but they were revolting by creating areas of privacy for themselves. The more modern revolts is you see people smashing surveillance cameras, marching in front of them, people holding up signs. There's a lot of revolt against surveillance cameras that doesn't look like political revolt because it's launched by the criminal classes, marginal classes, the working classes. Out in Jersey City, in New Jersey, for example, the surveillance cameras that the city are placing there have to be protected by bulletproof glass because gangs and people who want to be able to have anonymity in the streets are shooting the surveillance cameras out. And this has happened apparently several times in so-called gang areas on the West Coast. So there's all kinds of levels of revolt that's taking place to surveillance cameras. I would say it's only in the last year or two that people are actually beginning to go out onto the streets and make this an explicit part of political dissent, because it's only been recently that this has really been happening. What we should realize is that the surveillance state that's taking place now is something that would make the Nazis, the Stasi, the KGB, they would be jealous to be able to have these abilities. The Stasi, when they wanted to keep track or have unique bio-identifiers of people, they'd bring people into their office and they'd take a towel and they'd swab it underneath their arms. And they'd keep the towel with the smell of the person's body odor in a file cabinet so that that way a dog could then find that person later. That's how the Stasi used to keep track of people. When you realize that we're talking about implants underneath the skin and biometrics, we realize that no matter how scary and murderous the Stasi was, they never had technology that was at the level that Blair and Bush and the other world leaders have. And we should be really scared by this, given that the ruthlessness of the Stasi, even though they had technically unsophisticated ways of doing it, they were able to totally cow their population. And the fear is now, since the technologies of tracking and surveillance are even infinitely better, they will be that much better at cowing and pushing people into submission and passivity.
Under what conditions would this technology be used in ways that are more like what was happening in the Soviet Union and Eastern Germany?
Well, that's where we are now, is that we are using it. That supposedly there were television cameras mounted in public places, that there are such cameras mounted in public places in communist China, that this has been a feature of totalitarian regimes for 40 or 50 years, which is, of course, why George Orwell in 1984 made it clear that he thought totalitarian regimes, and he specifically had in mind the Soviet Union in this regard, would watch its citizens with surveillance cameras that would not only, or telescreens, as he called them, which would not only be out in public, but would also be in people's apartments. So that what we see now is that there's a continuity in methods between the totalitarian regimes of 50 or 60 years ago, but we have technology that they never would have even dreamed of.
Usually this is really used in, for example, a state of emergency. Are there other conditions when it begins to be used in a way that's way more unsettling or immediate than what we experience now?
Well, these sorts of surveillance cameras, or the idea of just surveilling public space indiscriminately at all times, that's a military idea. So you're right to say a state of emergency. If you've got a military base in Saudi Arabia, let's say, there's a permanent state of emergency because the Saudis do not want us in Saudi Arabia with a base. So you would surround your military installation with surveillance cameras and you do perimeter defense. And you'd assemble huge quantities of information that had to be scanned through and analyzed. But that's not what surveillance used to mean in law enforcement here at home. If you wanted to surveil somebody, you'd want not tons of information that you'd have to sift through and analyze. You'd want a little bit of information that would be introducible as evidence in court. So what we see is that when you put a surveillance camera in public and just watch continuously, without any regard for whether a crime is taking place or not, you've undermined civilian society and put a military model in its place. That's what happens with any surveillance camera. So then when you put a surveillance camera that has face recognition software on it or any of the other biometric programs, you've turned a state of emergency, because the military lives in a state of emergency, you've made that state of emergency, you've sort of inserted it into the middle of civilian society. And that's already damaging to civilian society. But now, since September 11th, and all the various terror attacks that are either fakes, true, to people doing opportunistic attacks, like the anthrax attacks, all of this now means that the state of emergency in civilian society can be encouraged so that more and more military surveillance at home in domestic society can be allowed. So yes, the more there's a feeling of state of emergency in America, that's the justification for installing more cameras, more different types of surveillance devices that are more and more sophisticated. So that's why we notice that at this time it's important for Bush and Mueller and Ashcroft to constantly keep the pressure on to give us the feeling that we're always at war. They always remind us, don't forget, don't become complacent, remember we're at war. And the reason is the war effort doesn't need that type of attention, but the effort to destroy civil liberties at home needs that as its cover. The more you tell people that you're under threat of death, the more likely they are to give away all of the rights that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights and the rest of the Constitution. So in other words, one of the most important things that can be done, I think, as either an anti-war activist, as an anti-surveillance activist, is to somehow get at this idea that we refuse to become panicked. That even when a gun is aimed at us, we refuse to ever become panicked. And that's something that's a personal ability, is not to become panicked, to not lose your head, but it's also something that we should encourage in society at large, and that when you don't lose your head, you're able to make more rational decisions. And right now we're encouraged to lose our heads and let other people make irrational decisions for us.
Are there cameras that are also hooked up to devices which can harm or restrain people?
Unfortunately, there are, and they're in use by the military now in Afghanistan, and they will probably be used in the future in domestic riot situations or disturbances. They're called either the Global Hawk or the Predator. And what these are unmanned spy planes that are covered with surveillance cameras so that they can go into harm's way and even be shot out of the sky and a human doesn't lose his or her life. If you had a U-2 spy plane, there's actually a pilot there who might lose his or her life if they're shot down. When I was in England, I saw video footage for something called Cypher. And what Cypher does is apply the same thing, this idea that you want to surveil a battlefield, but not a battlefield, but an urban riot situation. And Cypher is an unmanned spy camera that can go into a riot, and then if the person controlling this spy camera decides so, it can release a payload of tear gas. So that way, the police can actually go into the middle of a riot, a black block formation, disperse tear gas, and not have it thrown right back at them. Indeed, no policemen need to be there because a robotically operated camera with a weapon payload has identified the target and been able to discharge it. So again, what we see here is a militarization of law enforcement, and it becomes ever more frightening because it suggests that what the rulers of this society want is a society without people. They want to have an army that's entirely robotic, so it suffers no casualties. And that obviously implies is what they want is a whole society of robots who never riot, who never are unhappy, and if they do, they will be fought against by robotic cameras. So yes, what we will eventually see is cameras that not only can shoot pictures, but could shoot tear gas.
Hello, Bill. Can you please explain face recognition technology?
Yes. Well, I'm Bill of the New York Surveillance Camera Players. Chuck of the Arizona Surveillance Camera Players and I are now standing on 46th Street between 7th Avenue and Broadway in the heart of Times Square, which is indeed one of the locations where Howard Safier, who's now sits on the state Homeland Security Board put together by Governor Pataki, Safier wants to put 100 new surveillance cameras here into Times Square, all of them equipped with face recognition software. And what face recognition software, or FRS, to make it easier to talk about, is a computer program that automatically watches what comes over surveillance cameras. Usually what happens is that there's a human being there actually watching, and that person often makes decisions based on hunches, intuitions, prejudices, rank bias, sexual voyeurism, personal vendettas. All kinds of things can motivate a police officer watching a surveillance camera. And what FRS does is take that out of the hands of the police officer and makes it entirely an automatic decision based on whether the surveillance camera captures a photograph of you and whether it matches a photo of you that's in its database or not. And even though this is a fairly new technology, only about 10 years old, there's approximately a billion faces in databases all over the world. So if there are 6 or 7 billion people on the planet, we're already 1/6 or 1/7 of the way to installing this as a global surveillance system. In the United States, it's now being adopted very, very quickly at airports because it supposedly can be able to watch for protests, for terrorists. But the problem is terrorists are not in the databases of faces to begin with. So it's now being used in Oakland, Fresno, Providence, Logan Airport in Boston, a whole series of airports. And it's also being used in a couple of very specific areas for basically racial profiling, even though supposedly the technology takes it out of the hands of police officers, takes that bias out. It's being used in Virginia Beach, Virginia, which is an area where black sororities and fraternities meet every summer to party. And it's also being used in Ybor City in Tampa Bay, and that's a Cubano ghetto. So that even though the technology is presumably neutral, it's being used now in every incident in a very specific case of racial profiling, which is the problem with it, because even though it has the potential for indiscriminately surveilling everybody and violating everybody's rights, what it really does is redouble the suppression and repression of people of color.
selects them out and is able to focus on them in a way that a Justin Volpe or any other racist cop couldn't do, because a racist cop can't keep in his mind a million images and can't recall them instantaneously. He can't even have a book of photographs out in front of him. So it enables police racism to cyber cop levels.
Are there ways in which the technology can fail? For example, if a person wanted to thwart the technology, would that be pretty easy?
A person wouldn't even need to try to thwart it, because of the fact that photographs have to be perfect in order to recognize someone. The image in the database has to be nearly perfect, and the image that's captured live on the street also has to be perfect. The error rates for this technology are about 40%. Even the Department of Defense, which is obviously the culprits behind developing such a thing, even their own studies have false positive rates of 40%. Even if the false positive rate was only 0.1%, and you installed it in airports as we're doing, because you're dealing with millions and millions of people every day, 0.1% doesn't sound like anything, but if you multiply it by millions, you're dealing with so many false positive rates that on the one hand, you're violating the privacy of people who are falsely identified, and you'll be absolutely shutting down the airport because of the number of false positives. Just one false match, they don't know it's false, would take a half hour, an hour to investigate, and in the meantime they shut down the entire airport, they research everybody's bags, so it's not even practically workable. But that doesn't matter. Surveillance cameras themselves aren't practically workable. They don't cut down on crime. So what we have to understand is, even though face recognition won't do what it's supposed to do, even though surveillance cameras don't do what they're supposed to do, that doesn't matter to people like Howard Safier and John Ashcroft and Pataki. It's not here for the purposes of cutting down on crime or catching terrorists. It's here for the purposes of social control. That they've basically set up an environment here in New York City, even before FRS has arrived, in which people don't know that they're being monitored pretty much wherever they go. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't work for crime. What it works for is creating the feeling that the police have control, a secret form of control, that they then can use with impunity at any time. So you don't have to worry about getting your access to latex or being able to alter your face with surgical procedures to fake out FRS. You'd be able to do that probably with sunglasses and a beard easily enough.
Are there groups opposing this?
Yes, there are. There are groups in Florida, because that's where this first really hit. People at the Super Bowl were, without knowing it, were actually taped by FRS cameras, so that there were people involved in the indie media scene down in Tampa, Reclaim the Streets type of activists, who did something called Scan This. So about 100 activists went through Ybor City wearing masks, carrying signs saying, "Who watches the watchers?" Those are pretty much, other than the surveillance camera players groups, which are in New York, Tempe, Arizona, and the Bay Area of California, other people are involved in fighting face recognition software, but they tend to be mere advocacy groups. They're not activist or anarchist groups. So you've got the Electronic Frontier Federation, you've got the ACLU, even Dick Armey, a right-wing member of the United States Congress, even he's against face recognition. But all they're going to do is basically argue, produce briefs, make press conferences. It's important for average citizens to get out on the street now and demonstrate, because this is an environment in which our consent is just being assumed. Or it's just being mandated upon us, that we're being told you will consent to this. And it's very important, even if you're just four individuals, as will be today, it's important that people see that at least four individuals, perhaps in every city, are saying we're aware of what face recognition software is, and we want to stop it right now before any more is installed.
Any other comments?
Yes. Yes, I mean, presumably Times Square is an area that that a terrorist might want to attack. I think those of us who are either on the ultra-left or anarchists or autonome can agree that it is a potential terrorist attack. But the best way to protect Times Square is not to fill it full of surveillance cameras, because the only threat that's going to come to Times Square is going to be a truck bomb or a car bomb. If it's going to come from the skies in an airplane, no one's going to be able to stop it, as we saw with the World Trade Center. So if you realistically want to stop terrorism in Times Square, what you do is you seal it off, stop all automobile traffic, and turn it into a giant pedestrian zone. And in that way, the people who come to Times Square are safe from automobile accidents and deaths. We're safe from the noise and the pollution and the spectacle of these horrible things. And we're also safer from terrorism. And what's interesting about it is that during the time that I've been giving walking tours and performing in Times Square, the pedestrian areas are actually growing. To my left, where all this fucking honking is coming from, the pedestrian areas have been pushed an entire lane into the street because there are so many people on foot here. It takes, obviously, just a simple judgment to realize we can have our privacy, we can stop Times Square from being a terrorist threat, and we can get rid of the menace of the automobile all at once by making it a pedestrian zone. There are even some way out people that I've met who would suggest doing that to all of Manhattan. Ban all automobiles from Manhattan, and therefore make Manhattan completely safe from any terrorist attack coming from a car or truck bomb.
Thank you so much.
That's what I have to say.
Can you describe your group and what you've been working on, where you guys, what you guys are doing?
In Arizona, Tempe, we've been working since February, performing in front of webcams in public that broadcast people's images over the internet. They're government-sponsored webcams. Also, we've performed in bars that also have webcams inside the bars that we think is a clear violation of people's rights because they don't tell the patrons or the workers that they're being broadcast over the internet. And obviously, we're in front of surveillance cameras as much as possible.
Can you describe one of your performances or how your performances work?
Well, we have some certain issues in Tempe that we like to focus on. One of them is Joe Arpaio, who's the sheriff that has webcams inside of his jail cells. And basically, net surfers can go to his crime.com website and watch people get strip searched, beat up, if that tends to be the thing, be in the lineup, things like that. He says it's to scare people from going to jail, but basically just more and more people like to watch. And also another issue we deal with is reality-based television shows. Our group is against them, even though we find them very funny. We feel that it encourages the mass public to feel that it's okay to surveillance one another. That's basically what a reality television show does. It's allowing us to watch other people and say it's okay. In turn, the government can watch us, and we can't say anything about it because we'd be hypocrites if we told them to stop. Also, one more issue that we like to focus on is the Tempe sit-in. People are not allowed to like sit on the sidewalks, nor do they provide space for people to actually sit, such as benches or anything. So if you sit anywhere on the sidewalk in Tempe, you are fined heavily. And that also includes like skateboarding and bicycling. It's basically no fun laws that we tie to our group, along with our anti-surveillance, because we feel that the Fourth Amendment is essential to all of our work. We must preserve the Fourth Amendment along with the First Amendment.
How have people responded to your work?
Mostly positively. We've had some people say they disagree with us, but we thank them for their opinion and just give them a flyer. And we want them to at least be aware that the cameras are there. That's the first thing, because nobody knew the cameras were there. They're actually on top of Urban Outfitters. They're broadcasted on Tempe.gov under a link that's called Sneaky Peek. So most people have been very positive. I've gotten emails from people from other states that have seen us in Tempe thanking us for doing the work. Obviously, they would like to do it too, but they don't have the time or the resources. So we get a lot of thanks for doing it.
Any other comments?
One thing is that many people call us like ultra left and things like that. And in some spots we definitely are. But if you think about this issue of the Fourth Amendment is our Constitution. And we're trying to preserve our Constitution. And the government will call us all different types of names like anarchists and things like that. But in essence, we're trying to preserve how America came about in the first place. So I think it's kind of hypocritical of people that do that to us. Because I think the First and Fourth Amendment, personally, as being a theater artist, is essential. And it's also a human right. People should have protection of their privacy and should be able to say and protest whenever they feel like. My name's Charles Banaszewski.
From the Surveillance Camera Players in Tempe, Arizona.
Bill, could you explain the performance you just did?
Yes, what we just did is pretty much an untitled performance. I mean, in Star Hawk's The Spiral Dance, what we just did is called consecrating sacred space. Some of us don't really believe in any kind of deity or deities, so I wanted to keep it open as to whether we were consecrating public space or simply freeing it. But what we did was first we purified a circle. We cast it, and then we cast out evil spirits from it directly underneath the police surveillance camera, thereby implicating the police as an evil spirit and using sort of good magic to get rid of them. It's the only play that we've done like this. Normally, we use more rational methods of convincing them, but on the solstice, it seems important to use any and all methods available to us. And Starhawk is a great inspiration. She's written some things recently about what's happened since 9/11 and the anti-globalization movement that's really been inspiring. So this is kind of a tip of the hat back to her.
Thank you.
Or bullets.